welcome, all the good people out there. Thank you for tuning in today. Good to have you along for another episode of Red Ice TV. I'm your host, Henrik. I'm Swedish, and we've been doing our show since 2006, video version. We started out radio or podcast, of course, and we have morphed into covering really the intentional destruction of Europe and the West. And the attack by the globalists and the attack on nationalism and the rise, of course, of populism as well as a response to this horrible culture war that we are currently fighting. So today we're speaking with Ivan, who actually runs the YouTube channel Squatting Slav TV. I've been watching some of his video. He does some great stuff. He's out there on the streets. You know, he's engaging people. He's talking with Antifas and everything else. Great to have you with us, Ivan. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me on your show today, Henrik. I really appreciate it.
So, Slavs and squatting, is it true? The tracksuits?
you can see the track, the Adidas tracksuit is always on me, and unfortunately I'm not squatting right now, but I mean, 99% of the time I am, so you caught me on my off day today.
I thought it was just because you're really tall that you're squatting.
Well, I'm tall, and you know, I have to squat. It's the most comfortable position to be in when you're talking to liberals and snowflakes and SJWs.
Yeah, exactly. It's true. So tell us a bit about how you got into making videos and kind of what pushed you in this direction. Always interesting hearing about the path that people take.
Absolutely. So I started filming videos just this last February, so in February of 2017. And I started filming essentially because we had a few anti-Trump rallies here in Vancouver, Canada. So I went out essentially with my camera knowing, you know, that all kinds of people would be there, and I genuinely just wanted to see, you know, what they knew about Trump, why they had this displeasure with him, and why they disliked him. And the first protest I went to actually was the one regarding the Muslim travel ban. So I essentially went with my cameraman just jokingly, you know, to ask people questions and to see if I can get some reactions. And I ended up posting that video on YouTube. It got a pretty good response, you know, relatively quickly. I was shocked. I wasn't even aiming for it to, you know, have any kind of success or anything. And, I mean, just a few days after I posted it, InfoWars contacted me. I had an interview with them. And then after that, people sort of started asking me, you know, to put up more videos and started requesting all kinds of things from me. So that's where it kind of started, you know, just back in February of 2017.
That's awesome. So that's very recent, obviously. That's as cool as you've gotten into it. So were you always on this page? What happened? How did you, like, was it Trump, the rise of that, that you kind of reacted to, or what happened?
Mm-hmm. Well, the YouTube channel, I mean, is something that I had been, you know, thinking about for quite a while. I was always kind of interested in alternative news and humor and politics at the same time. So I kind of wanted to create a unique blend of all three of those. And, you know, the time that we're in right now really allowed for me to do that. And the rise of Trump, the pre-election sort of era, the post-election era, everything that came with it, really sort of allowed me to initialize this channel and really get it going. So, I mean, most of the videos you'll see on there are me talking to people, you know, at protests and demonstrations. But, you know, I definitely want to sort of take it in the direction where I'm doing more sort of commentary on various political and social issues while still preserving that original sort of sense of humor.
It's always good. People love, you know, when you get out there and kind of engage in some of these whack jobs, really, because that's what they are, obviously. We do need to laugh at these people. But we can talk more kind of about, I guess, the political situation in Canada and that stuff a little bit later. I'm interested in that because, obviously, as some people might have been able to decode from the background that we're on today, that's a Serbian flag. Your family, your ethnicity is Serbian. Your family are from there. You came to Canada when you were quite young, I believe. Just tell us a bit about that. Why, I guess your family obviously made the decision to leave. Was this due to the war and the issues with the Bosnia and the Croat situation at the time? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so my family left Serbia back in 1995. And I'm actually from the capital city of Belgrade, which wasn't directly inflicted by the war and by the conflict, but it was inflicted rather by economic sanctions. So at this time, the economy was terrible, and in 1995, my family decided to make the move here to Vancouver, Canada. It was a good decision to make. I've gone back to Serbia almost every summer. I have all my extended family there. So I kind of go back and forth between Canada and Serbia on a regular basis.
At this stage, because I think things are improving in Serbia, do you feel that you have a drive to, return and go there and stay there? Or what do you feel? Because, this is what it is. This is globalism. This is multiculturalism. Canada, of course, have been very inviting to the world, as many other Western European countries. And now I think we can truly begin to see the effects of that. It's one thing to help out other European nations in times of war and things like that. I am against mass movements of population, even if it's internally within Europe, but I understand the need to help each other out, obviously. But what's happening now is a completely different thing with mass migration from the Third World, Northern Africa, Middle East, etc.
Well, honestly, I would love to live in Serbia, but right now the economy is so stagnant that it's extremely difficult to make a living there. I mean, the average wage is maybe, 250 to 300 euros a month. And a lot of the prices there are equivalent to, prices in Western euros, in Western Europe, countries that use currencies like the euro. So it's extremely difficult to live there, but nonetheless, it's still a beautiful place. As you were mentioning, currently Serbia doesn't really have, any kind of problems in terms of conflicts. We did get, a lot of migrants coming through Serbia, especially during the peak of the migrant crisis back in 2015. But fortunately, Serbia was sort of just a station or a stop for them. When I was there in 2015, they would come in the morning, maybe 2,000 of them would come by buses in the morning, and they would leave the next day onto Germany and the rest of Western Europe. Once again, because Serbia's economy is not the greatest, and they don't have any social benefits to leech off of, as they do, in Germany and Sweden.
Yeah, exactly. They are heading in that direction. Where are the handouts? And maybe to a certain extent, in a weird kind of way, that's why countries like Serbia has been spared. It's just a gateway to welfare system in the West and stuff like that. Why do you think the economy is stagnant? Is it because of the setback? I went to Serbia. I went through there. I went to Belgrade, the white city, as it's called, beautiful city. A lot of things there, of course, to look at and history and all those kinds of things. They had also kept, of course, many of the bombed buildings as a kind of a memento to what happened, and the fact that NATO and the American allied had turned against the Christian Serbian people and sided with the Bosnian Herzegovina Muslim side, if you will.
Yes.
Are people generally, if you can speak in those terms, are people still upset about this? Did the country, was there a setback in the country because of the bombing and all this stuff, or what happened?
Well, there definitely was a setback. Serbia has survived so many wars, and then, the one in 99 obviously sort of added on to all of this. But it more so destroyed us morally, because every time you try to rebuild a society and it gets, pummeled to the ground again, you kind of have to start all over. So in terms of, resentment, there is a lot of resentment in Serbia, towards NATO and towards the entire scenario that took place back in 99. But at the same time, unfortunately, there's a lot of people, a lot of progressives there, who sort of completely forgot about that and who essentially don't really even care about politics all too much once again, because, they don't even have enough money at the end of the day to put food on their table. So the economy, just, addressing your previous question, the economy is still in a bad state. Essentially because of corruption, things like privatization and generally people just who are unable to get off their feet and start something on their own just because, you know, they don't even have the basic means to do so.
Let's talk a bit about Slobodan Milosevic and those kinds of things. Have you looked into any of that? I remember a couple of, like a year ago, I started to look at some of the speeches, mm-hmm. you know, by him. There's a website that lists them. I think I've referenced that before on the show. And it was interesting because it was clear to me reading the speeches that this fanaticism and kind of ultra-nationalism that they try to pin on him was mm-hmm. really not true. It was like he was a democratic socialist or something like that in terms of his political leanings. And what I got from that, I mean, this is a huge subject, obviously, a lot to deconstruct here, but basically, as I've understood it, the revisionist kind of cause in this is basically that he was defending himself and his people against these unfounded attacks that had come in. Is that true? Have you looked into that, or what happened?
To some degree, that's absolutely true. You know, he was trying to protect certain enclaves and certain parts of Serbia, that had ethnic Serbs living there, from, you know, various invaders, whether it was, Kosovo and the Albanians, or the Islamists in Bosnia. So, I mean, Slobodan Milosevic, at the end of the day, you know, he wasn't the best guy, but at the same time, he was definitely protecting national interests. And as we've seen over and over in the world, when you have a sovereign leader who's looking to protect his nation's national interests, this usually poses a problem to someone. And this is when they get labeled as the boogeyman, and when they're labeled essentially as human rights violators. So this is exactly how the conflict and the civil war started, back in former Yugoslavia.
Yeah, exactly. Here's a piece just from earlier this year, January. Serbia and Kosovo, quote, on the brink of war as troops line border to bomb nationalist train. I didn't follow the story at the time. Is there increased tension? Because I would figure if Serbia kind of voiced their discontent with what the globalists try to do at them, they would be in a position today where they basically cannot show any kind of level of nationalism because that would have echoes of that, you know, genocide that happened and stuff like that, right? There's a punitive, dismissive tendency by the global community to say, you're not allowed to have nationalism anymore because you did a boo-boo and a no-no a few years ago. is that true?
Absolutely. Nationalism there is frowned upon, because of our history, whether it was the genocide in Srebrenica back in the 90s in Bosnia, or the alleged ethnic cleansing of Albanians back in 1999, Serbia has sort of fallen back on the whole nationalist thing, basically because we're being told by the world, don't do this again, don't repeat this episode again, let's not have another repeat of the 90s.
Yeah. Ivan, tell me about, the relations between, or how you see East versus West right now. I mean, if we look, there was this famous, let me pull that up here, there's a good discussion point, this map that basically just shows, the terrorist acts in Western Europe, Scandinavia, compared to, for example, Poland or Slovakia. I don't see Serbia on this particular one, but I don't think there has been much there either. Why is this? Why the difference?
Well, once again, this sort of goes back to the migration patterns of all these people coming in from the Middle East and Africa. So they're not really settling in Serbia. They're not really settling in Slovakia, the Czech Republic, Poland. They're going to Western Europe, to France, to Germany, to the Scandinavian countries, Sweden, because once again, this is where they can reap all the social benefits. So the most terrorist attacks obviously occur where there's the highest concentration of these migrants. And that's exactly why we've been seeing so many attacks in places like London in the UK, simply because they have a very high concentration of migrants. Now, unlike Western Europe, unlike the UK, unlike Sweden, Poland has really put its foot down against migrants, and they've essentially said, stop, we're closing our borders, we're not accepting the EU migrant quotas, and this is working for them, and I believe that it's going to continue working for them. While in London, you have their mayor Sadiq Khan saying that terrorism is part and parcel of life in the big city, we have the Polish Prime Minister Peter Szydło essentially saying that, Europe needs to get off its knees and it needs to stop being lethargic, or otherwise they'll be, picking up their children off their knees for the rest of their lives as terrorism continues to grow and become an even bigger problem in Western Europe.
It's amazing that so few leaders in Western Europe see this, and at least the Eastern European ones are actually talking about this. I mean, and you referenced that clip. Let's just play that for people who might not have seen that yet. Of the Polish, I think she's the prime minister, not the president, the prime minister. Let's listen to this.
My chcemy pomagać ludziom, a nie elitom politycznym. I mam odwagę zadać elitom politycznym w Europie pytanie, dokąd zmierzacie? Dokąd zmierzasz, Europo? Powstań z kolan i obudź się z letargu, bo w przeciwnym razie codziennie będziesz opłakiwała swoje dzieci.
Yeah, I mean, she's the only European leader that has balls, maybe Orban and her at this point, right?
Orban, her, I mean, Marie Le Pen, obviously,
sure.
Was sort of on the same page, Geert Wilders as well. But yeah, I mean, in the present political sphere, definitely her and Viktor Orban are sort of leading and are really making their voices be heard regarding this issue, because it's getting to the point where terrorist attacks have become a weekly occurrence in cities like London. And unfortunately, I think that people in the West have become completely desensitized to this issue just because they've been conditioned to see it, on a weekly basis.
Here's another map tracking some of this stuff. It's just amazing. And as she said in the clip, she's talking about, well, these are incidents. Like, no, they're not. They're intentional. An incident is kind of an accident that never happened. That's an incident, right? And that's not what it is. And they call it a truck attack or weird things like this. Like, no, this is religiously driven people that are intentionally going after to kill as many as possible. So, I mean, what will it take, do you think? How much more will it take for Londoners and Brits and, Sweden's had it, Germany's had it, France. I mean, look at France, for Christ's sake. So many times now in the last 2 years that they've been hit as well. Are Europeans going to wake up, do you think, and try to, actually do something about this?
Well, unfortunately, I sort of feel that it's already too late for a lot of these nations. Blood is literally being spilt on their streets on an almost weekly basis. And, they're still, hashtagging not all Muslims, doing all these candle vigils, this and that. It's like, when are you going to wake up and say, okay, this needs to stop. It needs to begin with the government. We need increased security. We need to, strengthen and fortify our borders. So I'm at this point in time, I'm actually shocked that Western European nations haven't woken up and, taken a proactive approach, in lobbying their governments or even, protesting in the streets to stop these things.
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of time. I'm a bit more white pill than that. I don't think it's over. Maybe as the nation currently, the shape that it has, obviously. But at the same time, I kind of go back to this issue that, well, if that state of the nation created what we see in front of our eyes today, maybe that shouldn't survive in its current form, right? So I think it's going to go through a transformation. It's going to morph into something which, frankly, is stronger and better and more fit to handle these kinds of things. I think it's most Western European nations that have been, it was a long time ago since they were in these kinds of conflicts. And maybe that's the difference between countries like Serbia and Hungary and, let's say, even Romania, that was actually fighting actively against Muslim incursions like the Ottomans, right? That they have had a pressure from these kinds of threats for a longer period. Is that one explanation why they're more vigilant against this than Western Europe?
I definitely think that's the main explanation. Actually, Serbia in particular has been fighting against the Ottoman invasions since the 13th century. So, we've had centuries of experience with the Ottoman, and then also, that's just the thing. When I look at these terrorist attacks that are happening now, I see that as, I see this jihad right now as the same Ottoman ideologies that that were destroying Europe centuries ago. So I don't really see anything different. When people tell me, not all Muslims are extreme, this and that. Well, I tell them, hey, look at some of these Balkan countries. They've been at war with Muslims, with Islam, with the Ottoman Empire since the 13th century. Why don't you think that this scenario can be repeated again? Yeah. And I definitely do see that it's being played out again, in a different context, obviously, in a different time, but essentially it's the same thing.
I think as Eastern European countries begin to speak up, I think many in the West are going to follow, and they're going to see that the political will exists to do something about this. And I mean, again, it's great that other people, like even the interior minister, is talking to European leaders and saying this is insanity. You can't continue this. You must understand that these are weapons. The refugee crisis has been weaponized. It's done by not only European elites, but global the global elite as well. What do you think the outcome of that is that they want to see? Do they want to see war and conflict? Is that one of the reasons why they're doing it? Or do you think they're just in this pipe dream mode where they think truly that we're going to help all these people, it's going to be great, we're going to get together and have like a rainbow, not a nation, but an international community of just regions or something? I don't know. What do you think they're thinking about?
Well, as we've seen time and time again, the end goal of all globalists is essentially to divide and conquer and to undermine, strong nations and strong sovereign leaders. So every time we get, a Beata Szydlo or a Viktor Orban, a Geert Wilders or a Marine Le Pen, the globalists essentially will stop at nothing to demonize this person, to undermine them, and essentially, get them off the political scene. And essentially, that's exactly what we saw happening with Donald Trump on a sort of a higher level. So the goal of all globalists essentially, is, as we know, to have no borders, to destroy borders, national sovereignty, and to completely destabilize all of these nations. So as this push happens, for stronger leaders in countries across Europe, I certainly expect to see, a lot more undermining being done by the global elite to eliminate these players off the political scene.
And it is kind of strange, isn't it, that, Poland has, they've not had any terrorist attacks. So you'd think that they would be in a position where they would be like, well, see, so that's fine. We should welcome refugees, while the countries that have been hit hardest by refugees and the attacks are like, no, that's not a problem. Just, keep having them. But it's kind of a weird psychological thing. I don't know if there's something in the difference in the psyche. But I do think communism had something to do with it as well, that under the Soviet rule, if you will, of many of these countries, they could kind of see a similar pattern within the European Union, I think, and therefore they've been instinctively kind of resilient against that and said, whatever they're trying to push, I'm not so sure that that's a great idea. The experiences are very different, but it also shows, Ivan, that if you go through hardship, that kind of equips you better to see the reality of the world and not have these rose-colored glasses on, where you're too naive, and that's what I think the West is now. They're just too naive, right?
Absolutely, they're naive, but also I think it's sort of this older brother syndrome that's taking place within the EU, where you have Germany and France sort of trying to lead the European Union, set the examples for all these smaller countries such as Poland, and when you get a massive migrant crisis happening in these countries, and then terrorist attacks which follow, and all these disasters, these younger brother countries like Poland are gonna say, are gonna look and say, hey, look, well, the older brother screwed up. You know, why should we follow in his footsteps? Why should we let all these migrants in if we're going to be taken down the same path of destruction as they are?
That's right. I mean, I think it's insanity that they visually can see this and yet not doing anything about it. It's like a psychological disease or something. But as I said, I don't want to be too black, but I think that there's a turning point coming, and it's we're very close to that now. And I also think that the new kind of nationalism that we see that's on the rise on Europe is one that also is very charitable towards each other. To a certain extent, it is a pan-European cooperation. But these countries are still very much in line with their own culture, language, and identity. And I think, Ivan, that those are the issues that's going to protect us from globalism. It's going to protect our children from globalism, because one day, you know, the same issues are going to be pushed on them with it, where they say, well, you don't have an identity, or we're all the same, and it's kind of nonsense. The more layers of identity they have, the more protection we have against, you know, the propaganda working, basically. So I love what I'm seeing in Europe right now. It's solidarity with other European nations, obviously, but it's also a very strong individual ethnic identity.
No, I absolutely agree. What we're witnessing in Europe right now is essentially a sort of a nationalist and populist spring that's taking place, and that's, you know, catching on like wildfire. And you know, we have politicians like Geert Wilders, Marie Le Pen, you know, in the Polish Beata Szydlo. They're sort of leading this trend. They're the trendsetters. And once again, you know, the globalist regime is doing everything it can to sort of hush these people, silence them, and censor them, and demonize them, so that, you know, that they don't eventually become these strong European leaders that are essentially going to push this nationalist spring into an actual reality. So at current, I think, like you said, we are in this point of transition. How long it's going to take, you know, for people to sort of wake up is a matter of time. But the pot is definitely boiling, and I think that, you know, within the next few years, we're definitely going to see a tremendous turn, you know, in European political and national identities.
You know, I'm generally against a united, you know, European identity, which removes all the other ethnic identities or the sub-national identities. As I said, I think cooperation, solidarity, all these things are obviously understandable. It's something that we need. We need to help each other out and all that kind of stuff. However, one that I'm more okay with, I guess, is, let's say, a pan-Nordic identity or a pan-Slavic identity even. Is that something? What's happening on that front? Because obviously I see on your YouTube channel you have all the different Slavic nations and the flags for them, etc. Is there such a thing? Is there a pan-Slavic, not identity perhaps, but a cooperation on, I don't know, political level that's going on?
I mean, yes and no. You know, Slavic countries, you know, culturally are quite similar to each other, but then at the same time, you know, we've all had very different histories to some extent. So, you know, I'm all for preserving, you know, this sort of pan-Slavic love, you know, that we have for each other. But at the same time, I see nothing wrong with, you know, each nation holding on to its own customs, traditions, cultures, and, you know, just respecting everyone around them. You know, this, I think this can be done if we do have strong borders and obviously strong national leaders.
Yeah, is that the that's the trick we face right now? Obviously, in the sense that we have to regain control of our borders, and at some point it did work in Europe. We didn't have these massive waves of people coming out to the shores of you know, Greece and Spain and France, over the Mediterranean, over to Italy, you know, Sicily, and these kinds of things. Now, of course, we have boats, even from like Norway, they're down there just like collecting people and dumping them off in Europe. I mean, yeah. It's obviously that this is someone gave the go ahead. They're giving pamphlets and brochures. Go here, do this, talk with those people. Here's stuff along the way that you can get help and food and water and all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is intentional, is it not? They are trying to intentionally flood Europe with massive amounts of migrants.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, from a globalist perspective, it makes a lot of sense. You're taking people from some of the least developed and least progressive countries on Earth, some of the, you know, poorest countries on Earth, and you're pushing them onto Europe, so which is, you know, one of the most progressive continents on Earth. So you're taking the least progressive, pushing it onto the most progressive. Meanwhile, you're also pushing Islam essentially onto Christianity. So you're pushing two polar opposites against each other, and then you're saying, well, okay, it's time for you guys to get along. It's time for you to love each other, and it just doesn't work. And you know, by bringing massive amounts of Muslim migrants into Europe, you're essentially changing the demographic of Europe, changing the cultural and religious makeup of Europe as well.
Are you familiar with the Kalergi plan? Have you heard that?
No, I have not.
So it's this one guy that basically was a kind of an intellectual founder, really, of the pan-European ideal. He, together with Otto von Habsburg, one of from the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, Otto von Habsburg, a descendant from that, I should say, from the Habsburg line, they started thinking about these kinds of ideas of, like, how do we join, you know, co-join Europe? How do we create a kind of a, not an empire, really, but it was more like, the excuses that we hear today, of course, is because of the Second and the First World War as well. That's why we can't have nationalism. That's why we have to, you know, erode all these nations and stuff like that. But their work started right at the cusp before the First World War. Kalergi, he's remembered by the elite in European society today. For example, there's something called the Kalergi Prize. So certain politicians that have worked towards these goals and achieving them, they get literally a medal that says Kalergi. So he's not like a bozo that just came up with stupid ideas. He's very influential. But he proposed, you know, that the European man of the future needs to, like, look like the ancient Egyptians and stuff like that, right? It's almost like an intentional way of saying, you know, you're not, you as Europeans are not good. You have to breed yourselves out. And, you know, when you start looking at stuff like those pamphlets that have been released in Germany to migrants where they say, like, well, here's how you impregnate women. And, you know, the government is doing, like, sex ed courses to migrants. And we have the same thing in Sweden. You're like, you know what? It seems like that's what they're doing. You know, can you see it any other way? Have you seen some of that material?
Yeah, I absolutely have. The little instructional pamphlets. You know, that are telling them how to have intercourse, this and that. And, yeah, it's crazy, but that also kind of tells you, you know, that if you have to give pamphlets to somebody, you know, obviously these people are, you know, either primitive or their cultures and their views of your culture are so opposite that they don't even know how to treat women. So, essentially, they look at women as, you know, either objects or even as second or third class citizens. So that's what I find the most scary, is that, you know, we have to instruct these people coming in on how to act in Europe, how to behave, what not to do and what to do. And when it comes to that, then you obviously know you have a huge problem, and you know that these kinds of people will essentially have a great deal of trouble integrating.
And also, I think, you know, Ivan, that the more terrorism we get, the more isolated these communities are going to be from each other. It's not that we're going to say, oh, this is great, let's welcome these people now. That's not going to lead to some kind of mixed European race, I think. It's just very few that go in that direction, right?
Absolutely. And, I mean, I think that's you know, unfortunately already the case. I mean, look at places like Luton in the U.K., you know, this is a predominantly Muslim suburb of the city, and it's essentially almost a no-go zone for a lot of people there. And, you know, you come from Sweden, you have essentially the exact same problem in Malmo with Rosengard.
Yeah.
You know, a no-go zone where even authorities are afraid to go on their own. So essentially, you know, when you have these isolated enclaves, their intention, once they get big enough, of course, is to completely isolate themselves from, become self-sufficient, and obviously, put in their own laws and legal systems. And that's why a lot of these places, have been trying to, you know, establish things like Sharia courts.
And that's colonization. That's colonies in our countries, right? So somehow that's okay now?
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what it is. It's these mini colonies that essentially are living life the way they would have lived it back home, you know, while taking advantage of all these sort of, you know, socialist and democratic systems and platforms.
Yeah, they're taking advantage of the welfare system, and obviously we're you know helping these people, we're feeding them, we're paying their rent in many regards. Very few of them studies that have been made end up in the workforce in European society and continues staying there as well. That's very rare, you know. So at some point, there's a number of things that could give way here. It could be the financial issue that these countries just can't bear the responsibility anymore. I know in Sweden we have a huge problem with housing, for example. Our own young people that want to, you know, get out in life and start up a family or, you know, get a place of their own and stuff like that, they're basically in a state of arrested development and they can't take those initial steps because all the apartments and houses are either rented by the government directly and then handed off to the refugees, or they're giving an advancement in queue. And I don't think that, you know, when you begin to encroach on the comfort zones of regular normal life of people, that's when you begin to have a problem, I think. And I think that that's going to be when they can't go out on the street anymore, they can't get what they want. That's when I think you'll begin to see a change towards the direction that we know this is going to go. I still think, though, there's not enough people that are too uncomfortable yet, if you know what I mean. It's like we have to be pushed out of that comfort zone to be able to dare go for a different political solution or adopt an ideology which basically says, you know what, we've had enough. This is not working. It's leading to chaos. Multiculturalism doesn't work. Because I think we'll end up there eventually, Ivan. It's just a matter of time. What do you think?
Right. And I mean, it's interesting that you mention the housing crisis as an example, because essentially we have the same issue happening here in Vancouver. You know, Vancouver has essentially become a laundromat for foreign investors, and primarily those coming from Asia. So, you know, the average person here can't afford a one-bedroom, a $500,000 condo. So, you know, how long is it going to take for us to be pushed to the brink and realize that things aren't working, that these policies aren't working for us, is really a question of time. You know, is it going to be the next 2 years, or are we going to allow it to get really, really, really bad, you know, before we sort of, stand up and say, okay, listen, this has to stop and things have to change.
Yeah, let's talk a bit more about Canada in the next segment. We're going to take a break in a little bit and then continue. There's many more things we should discuss. But obviously, we want to encourage people to head on over to YouTube channel, subscribe, check out some of the videos. He's working on new things all the time. Do you have anything big in the works, in the plans, upcoming stuff you'd like to let our people know about?
Yeah, I'll actually be releasing a video tomorrow that's sort of a sequel onto the whole situation with Poland and Hungary as well, and you know their stance that they've taken towards the migrant crisis and as well as, you know, Soros and globalism.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely heads up on that, ladies and gentlemen. But yeah, check out a lot of good episodes there. And of course, yeah, the Poland one has had over 200,000 views. It's pretty good. People are interested in that, aren't they? They want to know what's going on in Poland, you know?
Absolutely.
Stay tuned for Hour 2 with Squatting Slav. Head on over to redicemembers.com if you're not a member already and sign up. You can check out all the second hours of our interviews. Plus, you get access to all the video material and you can watch the live TV show that we broadcast exclusive for members most Saturdays. We have all the previous shows archived there for you. We are doing our 40th episode this coming Saturday, the 17th of June. Beyond our vast radio and video archives with inside episodes, reviews, special original segments, we have well over 40 hours of recorded archived live Weekend Warrior shows for you to enjoy. These are both important and informative, but also entertaining and lighthearted. Some great segments and topics covered in those shows. So if you're new to the show or if you've been watching and listening for a while, you'll definitely enjoy those. It's only €6 per month. We have memberships from 3 months up to 2 years, and the price per month goes down the longer subscription you get as well. So that 2-year one is a pretty nice deal. This is a great way to support us, keep us going, and expand in our coverage. So thank you for watching and listening, guys. We'll be back in just a few days, but hour two coming up right now with Squatting Slav. Stay tuned.